101, a version 1 podcast.
Hi everyone, Paul Slade here from version 1 with Scott Carey, who's the group editor of UK B2B at IDG Communications. Welcome to the 101 podcast, Scott.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yeah, good to have you with us. I guess to kick off, it would be useful if you could tell us a little bit about your role at IDG Communications, I guess in the various publications you're sort of responsible for.
Yeah, IDG tends to kind of fall on deaf ears, but our main publications on the B2B side are Computer World, Tech World, CIO and CSO. So we kind of cover the whole technology industry from kind of startups all the way up to the very senior ranks of the technology business, with the CIOs and the CSOs looking after kind of big IT organizations and security operations there. So I've been covering this business for coming on 5 years now. And in that time, I've covered everything that I just mentioned, you know, right from, burgeoning UK startups through to IT organizations. And I think we're going to talk a lot about kind of how they're transforming and trying to keep pace with those kind of very innovative young organizations, and then right to the senior ranks as well.
Excellent. That's great. So, I mean, what's your background? What sort of got you interested in this particular space?
It's funny, actually, a friend of mine who I went to university with, we did journalism postgraduate diplomas, and in this industry, you're never quite sure what you want to cover when you come out of that. You normally have an idea. Maybe it's sports, maybe it's pop culture, maybe it's something you're interested in. Most people don't think B2B technology, but funnily enough, my friend was covering it at IDG at the time, and I was kind of enviously looking over at what he was covering. He was covering Facebook and Google and all of these companies that were, at the time, people thought of very kindly, and they were really changing the world. And I kind of wanted a piece of it. So I tried to make inroads into the technology business and start covering it. And it's changed a huge amount in those 5 years since I got involved with it.
Yeah, it's a very fast-moving industry, isn't it? And I think we know that all too well in version one. But I guess you would have seen a lot of industries, you know, a lot of organizations who are going through, you know, some challenges in terms of understanding how they leverage modern technology in a more digital way that in a fast-moving organization. So I guess what we're keen to understand is sort of how, what you've seen, and how organizations can help set themselves up for success in a modern digital world, really.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about setting those foundations to success in the digital space. So one industry that I cover a great deal is the financial services industry, and it's a really interesting one for me at the moment, because you have that, you've seen the fintech sector grow very quickly here in the UK, here in London in particular, and the success that the Monzos and the Starlings and the Go Cardless of this world have had transfer-wise in kind of really shaking up how people deal with their finances. And what we've also seen on the other side is a banking industry that's been pretty slow to catch up. So what I've been interested in tracking, and I'm interested in talking about today, is how the banks have gone about setting themselves up to compete with those fintechs and also keep pace with the changing expectations that comes with that. And for me, there's two aspects to that. There's the very boring side, which is, you know, really just setting up your systems and your technology to be able to do all of that sexy stuff on the front end. And that's definitely not as easy as people kind of think. And then also changing your culture to be a bit more innovative and take some more risks. The interesting thing with the financial sector in particular, and the reason I chose it as my kind of example here, is that they've been forced to do this by the regulators. The open banking regulations that came in January 2018 made the big nine UK banks, the CMA 9, open up their users' transaction data via a set of secure APIs. And that was the first time they'd ever had to do that. And by forcing them to do that, it also forced them to really drastically rethink how they treat customer data, how they can leverage that to deliver value to customers, and how they can start to develop some of those kind of fintechy features for their users as well, longer term. So what started as a, a pretty dry compliance exercise for some of the banks, and definitely not all of them, but for some of the banks, they've suddenly realized that actually this is a good way to set themselves up for future success in the digital arena.
Wow. I mean, what sort of things did you see are sort of in that space in terms of what did they have to, like they hadn't thought about before that they need to sort of get involved in, I guess, to make that happen?
Yeah, so one thing, so HSBC and Nationwide are two banks that are kind of a little bit more open with me in the press than maybe some of their competitors are. So they're the ones that I really have a decent amount of insight into what they've been up to in the last couple of years as they've been adapting to this new world. And really what they've been doing is adopting these modern technologies, most of which are kind of based in the open source world. So it's Kafka for streaming data. What that allows them to do is adapt and personalize offers to customers in a more real-time way. So when their data used to be kind of stored in these legacy systems and they were siloed away, it was very difficult for them to kind of deliver an offer in any kind of speed or kind of get any insights into what a customer's up to at any speed. So if you're a Monzo customer, for example, you'll get a text message from them or a push notification from the app the minute your plane touches down in a new country, and they'll give you all the information you need about what your ATM limits are and things like that. Whereas I remember when I would go abroad with my bank and I would have to maybe remember to ring them up before I went and be like, by the way, I'm going away, please don't block my card. And, you know, little things like that, people like to put the boot into their bank for you know, that sort of customer service, but it's not easy on their side to adapt to that. They need to change a lot of the systems and a lot of the way that they handle their data. And what open banking did is it forced them to rethink the architecture really of their data and start to get it in place where they could put it into APIs and start to put that forward in the open banking world. But then also it enables them to do all of this other stuff that they were seeing. So there's kind of that dual benefit of that.
So what do you, in terms of the, I mean, do you see this as a big challenge for them, because primarily they're a bricks and mortar organization working in a modern world, and a lot of the online sort of providers in that particular space are much faster moving, can move a lot quicker. What was the key ingredient for them to be able to do this really, really quickly and easily, and actually the bricks and mortar organizations, the banks that can't?
Yeah, I mean, the key challenge for them was always going to be kind of changing mindsets. You know, they've had a way of doing things from an IT perspective for a long, long time, and they've got a lot of kind of really calcified in systems that they've had to keep upright just to keep their business going, and they don't really want to touch them because in case they touch them and they kind of fall down. And you look at what happened at TSB, which is a real case study in kind of how not to do it, because they tried, you know, a big bang migration away from their old system to this new system to set themselves up for future success. But they botched the migration, frankly, and then that caused them so many problems, and they're still dealing with the fallout from that. So there are risks involved here, and I don't doubt that TSB had the right people and the right process in place. It's just these things kind of sometimes happen. So I think that's definitely set a lot of people back in terms of how much risk they want to take in terms of moving systems to these modern architectures. But the other thing is they do have the resource, and they have to do it. They have to do it because the regulators are making them do it. So there's a certain amount of room to kind of do this activity and to kind of modernize that wasn't there before.
So, I mean, I can imagine that there must be quite a large cultural and behavioral change that needs to take place in these organizations. I mean, how have you seen, I guess, those organizations tackle those sorts of things in the marketplace? Particularly, I can imagine the more modern banking, online banks don't necessarily have that issue in the same way. But the larger bricks and mortar ones will do.
Yeah, the culture piece is obviously the other important side. And what we've been seeing is, let's take Nationwide, for example. They've made a big investment in their IT in general. But what they've done is they've opened they're opening a brand new London development center, which is only going to be kind of full of these modern cloud, web-based, mobile-first developers that have grown up in this world. And I think you have to find a way to attract and retain those people if you want to succeed in this world. And the way that they've gone about that is by opening in London, because frankly, that's where a lot of the talent resides. They're based in, where are they based? They're based Swindon, I believe. And no disrespect to Swindon, but I think they struggled to find the people they needed to there. So that's why they made this investment in London. And what I've also seen, another great example, I think, in this space is that at Barclays, they hired a new head of digital. I don't think that's exactly the right job title, but you've got my gist.
Yeah.
Megan Kaywood, and she came over from Starling Bank. So she had spent a couple of years at Starling Bank building this platform business and this modern way of banking and thinking about your bank not doing everything, but actually plugging into a lot of providers and providing customers with value in a different way. And that, you know, that's a drastically different philosophical approach for a lot of these banks. But Barclays hired her, and they hired her because they probably believe that that is the direction of travel. So you can see that making those kind of high profile hires is another signal that that's the direction they're going to move in. And then it's her job really to kind of execute on that and get those people into the building. And it's different. I know that you've worked a lot in the public sector, and that's always been a challenge there, is finding the right people. But in the banking world, frankly, they can throw a bit of money at this. Mm. So if they really want to, they can move their organization in that direction. But what you need is the senior buy-in. You need the senior leadership to want to do this. Otherwise, you probably won't succeed.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with that one. So, and I think that's the key bit, isn't it, around the buy-in at the senior level at the top. And actually, interestingly enough, one of the things that we often see is actually the top might have the buy-in, and actually the people that are doing have the buy-in, but actually it's that bit in the middle, mm-hmm. the meat in the sandwich that typically feel like they're being left out of the story. I mean, have you seen organizations sort of deal with that sort of piece of the pie, I guess, you know, that cultural change within the organization to overcome some of those challenges?
Yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, frankly, it's obviously really difficult. And the other thing being in the press is that organizations don't like to talk about that stuff.
No, they don't.
So often that stuff doesn't kind of come through as clearly as the big transformational efforts and the big grandstanding about, you know, we're changing our culture and things like that. But I think it just kind of has to happen. I keep hearing about those from a career perspective. I think that's the way that a lot of these organizations will sell it in, is you've got to relearn and you've got to learn these new skills and you've got to move to this kind of cloud way of working. Otherwise, you're going to end up kind of in the cupboard keeping the servers up and running, but your career progression maybe is going to be a bit stunted by that. Because if you're an employee at one of these organizations, and it doesn't have to be banking, it can be retail, it can be telecoms, you're probably starting to see the writing on the wall a little bit here. And if you're not adapting to that, you're going to become a dinosaur pretty quickly. So there's a certain amount of sending that message from a senior perspective, but then also relying on your employees to kind of get that message, and that's not always easy.
No, I agree. And I mean, you mentioned cloud and cloud technologies, and I know that's an area that you've done a bit of work in as well. And what are you seeing in that particular space, and some of the, I guess, the providers of cloud solutions and technologies? What are you seeing in the marketplace that is, I guess, evolving very, very quickly?
Yeah, I've just seen like a way of working emerge, a kind of agreed upon way of working emerge, and it's buzzword bingo. It is DevOps, it is microservices, it's a lot of open source these days, and being able to get your head around some of those technologies. And, you know, that doesn't mean that you can't go and buy it off a commercialized vendor like a Pivotal or someone like that, but you need to get your head around how all of that stuff fits together and how to operate a cloud environment securely. So I think that is the direction of travel. And I think most of the banks now and most organizations now are talking about moving towards becoming cloud companies, even the ones that were the most conservative. So those are the skills and those are the capabilities that you kind of need to start bringing into your organization. And what that is it's really changed the way IT organizations work. That DevOps mentality and smaller kind of chunks of applications and containers and all of the stuff that comes with working in that way seems to be becoming the new normal. And I don't imagine that anyone kind of really fighting against that is going to last particularly long. They're going to have to probably eventually adapt to that.
Yes, no, I agree. I mean, what about some of the largest sort of cloud solution providers in that space, like the Microsofts and the AWSs of this world? I mean, how are you seeing them in that in the marketplace, I guess, potentially competing in that space together against each other and with others as well?
Yeah, what I see from the cloud providers is a couple of things, but mostly their main goal tends to be to simplify things. So it's all good talking about containers and DevOps and microservices, but really it's all happened so fast that what they want to do a lot of the time is their value as a cloud provider is to simplify those things. So you see a lot of managed Kubernetes services coming out of those vendors now, and ways to kind of simplify that orchestration layer, and also things like serverless computing, where you don't have to worry so much about standing up infrastructure when you deploy. And also the other way that these providers tend to really want to compete is on the machine learning, the AI, on the kind of the front edge of things, and giving people access to those advanced capabilities. Google in particular has always been strong on that front because they've developed very, you know, good machine learning stuff in-house, and a lot of their customers are like, we want a bit of that. How can you expose that to us in the way that is kind of a service? So that tends to be the way they go about things, I think.
Okay. I mean, you touched on a couple of sort of, I guess, more innovative technologies, I guess, you know, and that's a big area for our audience. You know, they're quite keen to understand how innovation is evolving, I guess, in the marketplace as well. You know, some of the things like, you know, virtual reality and augmented reality, AI, those sorts of things that are typically in the past have primarily been seen in sci-fi films.
Yeah.
But now, I mean, are you seeing those sort of more innovative technologies coming into mainstream sort of, I guess, building of solutions and technology?
Yeah, not really. Yeah. I mean, we're still, I think, on the hype curve on a lot of these things. I think machine learning is an interesting one because it involves so many different aspects, and people kind of band them all together. But there is machine learning in practice. There's a lot of organizations that are starting to personalize offers at scale for their customers from a marketing perspective, and they're using machine learning to do that. And there's also you're starting to see some blockchain in action now. You're starting to see some organizations deliver distributed ledger technology, not just for cryptocurrencies, but also mainly to kind of track things in the supply chain. So it's that irrefutable ledger of activities. And a lot of the banks also are interested in moving their old school kind of ledger technologies to a distributed ledger. But it's still early days on a lot of that stuff. And AI as well is still in that early stage of AI where it's not particularly intelligent. You kind of have to tell it what you want it to do, and it will do that very well, and it will do it at massive, massive scale. But it's not quite at that intelligence level that people, maybe the sci-fi example that you talked about, are expecting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, television sort of tells a few lies, doesn't it? At the end of the day, we know that. I guess around innovation in particular, I mean, that's sort of, How do you see organizations setting themselves up to, I guess, not necessarily be ahead of the curve, but understand the impact that that has for them as an organization in terms of innovation? I mean, some companies have, you know, little innovation labs or whatever. What are you seeing in the marketplace around that particular space?
Yeah, so I think this is a good way to kind of wrap up everything I've been saying, is that I think you have to put the foundations in place. And I think what a lot of organizations have learned over the last couple of years is that idea of setting up a small innovation lab in the corner with some smart people, or building an accelerator program and getting some startups in and trying to learn from them, it hasn't really paid dividends. It hasn't really led to many results. And the reason for that is because the foundations aren't there. They don't have the access to the data they need, or the access to the tools they need, or the buy-in from certain people they need to get that stuff off the ground. So it's all been a bit kind of, it's all been quite
disjointed.
And a little bit theoretical rather than being able to deliver it. But that's the exciting change that I've been seeing in the last few months, is that now that organizations are realizing, all right, we've got to put in the hard yards here. We've got to unify all of our data. We've got to make our systems more modern, more responsive, more agile, more automated. But that's when the innovation will follow, because once the systems are set up in a place where you can deliver those innovative capabilities. And once you've started to build your teams and have people in the building that are more used to innovating in that way, I think those use cases, those innovative use cases, will come afterwards, because people have the foundations and they have the framework in place to be able to bring those value-added services and features to customers. So I do think that it's not a sexy answer, and it's not, and it means a lot of short-term, medium-term, maybe even long-term pain in terms of getting there, because change is hard. But that, I think that's the only way to get true innovation. I don't think there's a quick fix. I don't think there's a silver bullet. I don't think there's, you know, a magic way of creating innovation in a way that a lot of people talk about. You know, it's like, oh, just go and do innovation. I don't think it works that way.
No. I mean, you know, there's no point in innovating something that's, if, you know, if it's not adding value. I guess that's the key thing, isn't it? It might look cool, but actually, at the end of the day, it's got to add value to the organisation and the business, which is really, really important. And in relation to innovation, sort of what are the key blockers that you typically might see in this space? And, you know, I'm thinking things like security, thinking things like personal data, GDPR regulations, all those sorts of things. You sort of alluded to the fact that actually that's sort of getting access to that sort of information and those systems that enable you to do that in a way that helps innovation develop. What are you seeing as sort of the key blockers that organisations might want to think about? Actually, how do we look at that differently, possibly, so that we can actually start to look at innovation in a different way?
Yeah, funnily enough, I think actually GDPR was initially seen as a blocker, but a lot of organisations, and they might well be lying to me, this might be, you know, this might be their kind of silver lining thinking. But what GDPR has done for a lot of organisations is it's given them the impetus to get their arms around their data and what they can use and how they can use it, and getting it all into one place. So what that's actually done is, yes, it might have reduced the kind of footprint of data they have, but they now have a better route to using that in a way that they, you know, that is legal and applies to the, you know, complies with the regulation. So that's provided a big opportunity for a lot of organizations. In terms of remaining blockers, I think it tends to be mindset. I think a lot of these organizations that we're talking about, the bricks and mortar organizations, we often call them legacy organizations, but they obviously hate that, is mindset. It's risk aversion and thinking, you know, our business is fine. I think the telco business is one that has long been kind of been able to rest on its laurels. It's, you know, there's limited competition. They're set up to do what they need to do, and there hasn't been a lot that's come to market that's made them have to really rethink their business. That's changing. 5G is changing that. They're starting to really think about how they are going to attract and retain customers in the 5G world, and what that looks like, and what services they can offer. And I was talking to some people from GIFGAF yesterday, the telco network provider that's part of O2, and they are really thinking hard about how they can set themselves up for the 5G era, and how they can provide you with the best tariff and at the best time, and start to give you real-time access to your usage, and start to see what you are using, what you aren't using, so you can really start to personalize your tariff and not have to pick between, you know, the six that they provide you, and you have to spend hours working out which one's the best one for you. So there's a lot of opportunities in that area. But yeah, it's a changing mindset and being a little bit more open to taking risks and moving into that new world. And Kodak's always the example, but, you know, no one wants to be Kodak.
No one wants to be Kodak. All right. Well, I mean, we could, I guess, chat for hours on this, but I think we can pick it up another day, I think. But thanks for your time, Scott. Thanks very much for joining us on the Version 101 podcast, and look forward to speaking to you again soon in the marketplace.
No, thank you. Thank you for putting up with me on my soapbox.
Well done.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the 101 podcast. If you would like more information about any of our podcasts or our guests, visit us at version1.com/1-0-1.